So 4 years ago, after the previous series of conventions, summer conventions, just to refresh, I'm more interested in political conventions than the Olympics. This is a little loud, huh? So I tried to avoid speaking directly on politics, but what I did address, I recall, was Bill Clinton's speech. That it was the most phenomenal oratory tour de force. And as a public speaker, I learned a lot from it. So I want to start by talking about two of my favorite speeches from the conventions this year. My first was, I think it was a gentleman who was a CEO of a hedge fund who introduced Ivanka Trump, and the whole thing was like an extended wedding toast. It was a very, very surreal experience. It was not a political talk at all. He kept referring to telling old stories and things you might not know about Donald and Ivanka, and it wasn't even standing at a podium. He was walking around like a Donahue used to. And my second favorite speech, my other favorite speech, I don't know if I have a top favorite, was the, I think he was a general who shouted his entire speech. Did anyone see that one? that was it, because I was thinking I don't display a lot of outward emotion during my speeches. I kind of am not a quiet speaker, but a calmer speaker, and I thought maybe I should try that, just shouting the whole speech. So although I typically don't address politics from the Bema, this year feels like it's going to become an exception, and over the holidays I'm thinking about some things I do want to say politically, so I've started to formulate some ideas, and this parasha is a nice segue into that because it conveys to us a lot of the principles of being a... Is the sound off? Is it problematic? There's a lot of... let me see if I can make it adjust a little. I'm loud and clear? Okay. Too loud and clear. Well... Do you know the sound system at all? You want to just turn on the main volume a little? Or turn down actually my volume a little, maybe? That'll do it. Just a hair. You usually don't need more than a hair.
Sounded like I was mic'd also, so there are two reasons to turn it.
Yeah. So one of the interesting midrashim, so this week's parasha addresses a lot of the issues. It's a really nice transition from the stories and adventures and misadventures of the desert, which is most of Bamidbar, the Book of Numbers, is these misadventures in the desert. And Devarim, Deuteronomy, will be Moses' valedictory to the people. And this is the transition where they start to kind of assess where they've been and where they're going and start to plan, not just for the conquest of the land, but did that go off now?
No.
Still on, okay. Not just for the conquest of the land, but the use of the land. Just a little? It's fine. It's just leave it for now. It's fine. I'll deal with it later. Sounds great? Okay, good. So one of the wonderful midrashim, you know, it's interesting that so much of our religious life, Rabbi Cook, one of the first chief rabbi of Israel, talked about the pyramid, the triangle between God, Torah, and Israel, the land. And kind of advised that the land is this unusual aspect of a religious system. And in a midrash this week, it's told to us that the land fits us, which suggests to me a lot of things about civic engagement. You know, I was going to ask you, where are some of the places that you've lived, just maybe a few, that have really spoken to you, that really suited your soul well outside of Knoxville? Has anyone lived anywhere that they remember fondly and they think that was a great place to live? For me, one of them is Jerusalem. Jerusalem?
Frederick, Maryland.
Yeah. From your story, I remember your parents, right? Frederick, Maryland.
Ithaca, New York.
Ithaca, New York, yeah. College towns, oddly, yeah.
Manawan, New Jersey.
So places, there are places that speak to the soul, and the relationship of Israel to the land suggests a broader relationship that when we find a place that works for us, and by virtue of the fact that almost everyone here, I believe, is an American citizen, we have made that commitment to a land. We have some duties to care for it. So we're told many things in this week's parasha about how to orient ourselves and how to administer the land of Israel. And that one of the first things we're told is about the wars against the Midianites and how to lay siege to them. And Maimonides, in his legal commentary, refers to this about how to lay a siege, that you should lay a siege not surrounding it on all four sides, which is actually pretty poor military discipline, but only from three sides, leaving a way for anyone to escape who wishes to flee, which begins to suggest a civic principle of moderation and generosity and not absolute victory. That we, unfortunately it doesn't seem like this is the way of this election, that when we address our adversaries in the political domain, that our goal is not to crush them. Our goal is to have a common discourse and to surround them with wise arguments on all three sides, such that on the fourth side, perhaps, they might find a different recourse. They might find a different way to behave, a different policy choice. And that our goal in war, as in peace, is not absolute domination, but... Pardon?
No.
Okay.
I'm just saying, he says, kill them all.
That aside, yeah. Okay. I get to choose what I put in my sermon, though, so that's... editing is a very, very important job of a rabbi. Clever editing. So this is also the parasha where two of the tribes, Gad and Reuven, and half of the tribe of Manasseh, decide that they don't want to cross the Jordan River. They would rather settle in the steppe in the highlands of the Moab. That's better for their sheepfolds and better for their lifestyles. And they say they want to build sheepfolds and houses and homes there. And Moses, notes Rashi, responds to them after a bit of deliberation and negotiation, yes, go ahead and build cities and sheepfolds. He inverts the order. And what Rashi points out is that Moses says to them, make the primary thing primary and the secondary thing secondary, which in civic discourse is a very important thing. You know, you can't achieve everything. You can achieve, as one of my employers said, you can do anything in life, but not everything. And any policy decision, any political question often comes down to the arena of compromises, that economics is the study of limited resources, so say economics theoreticians. That in a political discourse, you can't have everything you want. No budget is perfect. No institution has unlimited resources. So in a world of unlimited resources where you can't please everyone, how do you set priorities? There's a new book that came out that surveys Obama's foreign policy and tries to ascertain from within what were his priorities in foreign policy. But that is an important piece of public discourse, is setting the public priorities, that being a civic duty is to participate in announcing what you think are the values on board and what should be the values for the community. The rest of the morning, I also want to address what's a very peculiar mitzvah that I read in my Torah reading, the cities of refuge. There are three cities on one side of the river, three cities on the other. They're carved out more or less from the other tribes, more or less the way Ottawa and D.C. have been. And if you commit a manslaughter, not a murder by premeditation or not a violent murder, but an accidental death, if you cause an accidental death, and you have to, you know, sort of imagine yourself in a pre-legal, pre-rule of law time where the justice doing of the age was just by retribution and vendetta. And you have societies where one might accidentally kill your uncle, so you kill him, and then someone else has to kill you, and you just go back and forth. So we were trying to interrupt somewhat of a lawless system with an institution of rule of law, and the way they did it was a cooling chamber, as we describe our Senate, a cooling chamber of ideas where the manslaughterer would go to a city of refuge, one of the six cities of refuge, during the reign of that particular high priest and could wait out the venom and the vendetta of the family that might try to find justice and recourse directly. That someone might want to kill you for an accidental death of their family member, so you go to a city where you can be safe and protected. And what gives us a lot of insight, first, that simple law is itself an insight into what makes good civic discourse and what civic duty represents and what our duties as citizens are. The Bible, Torah, I think, with all of its flaws, is trying to create a system of law, a rule of law, where in previous to the Bronze Age, my guess is things were mostly clan-based, vendetta-based, honor and shame-based. There was no overweening or supervening law. There was no sense, as the Torah says, of one law for you and for the sojourner, for the foreigner. That everyone obeyed whatever force was the law, power was the law. And Torah is trying to replace a system of arbitrary justice with one of consistent rules. So some of the commentaries on the law of the city of refuge are very revealing. The Talmud says, I love this little midrash, but I think it teaches us something too. The person who went to the city of refuge had to remain there until the death of the current high priest. The Talmud has this beautiful image that the mothers of the high priest would feed the criminal, would feed the manslaughter, would care for him, because they didn't want him praying for the death of their son. So, which is to say, if my child was the high priest, God forbid, and Karen would pray for and feed and give to the manslaughter such that the manslaughter and his family wouldn't pray for the priest to die so that he could be released from his servitude, or his, more or less, it's a house arrest is effectively what happens. You wind up under house arrest in this one city you can't leave for fear of being killed. I think it gives us a sweet sense of that justice is not retributive, that in a civil society we are bound to each other, even those we might not like to worry about, and that our goal is to care for the weakest, and that everyone has a piece in it, that there's some amount of intellectual charity that's required. I mean, of all the people to pray for the murderer, the mother of the high priest seems a very odd choice, but there is a level of intellectual charity that's required in civic discourse, which seems sadly lacking. And here's another one. Maimonides has this to say about those cities of refuge. I find this very interesting, that the cities of refuge are so important, and this seemingly odd and trivial or quirky mitzvah, this obligation to build these six cities, is so important that the court is required to straighten the roads that lead to the cities of refuge, to repair the roads, to broaden the pathways to the cities. They have to remove the impediments and obstacles. You have to build bridges so that one who flees can get there easily. And even there's a limit to the minimum width of the road, that the roads leading to the cities have to be easily accessible and well signed. There has to be good signage leading to the cities of refuge. It has to say refuge, refuge, and point this way at all crossroads so that you would know your way and get there easily and quickly. That was the royal road. That the implementation of justice and rule of law for our ancestors and for us is so important that it requires what economists would call public goods, lighthouses and bridges, things that we all use but none of us actually pay for one at a time, that have a net impact and a net positive to society, but we don't have an individual stake in. That they understood, even in that era, first the era of Torah, and then the era of Maimonides, which is effectively the 11th century, that some things had to be maintained by society, that there were that pure libertarianism, pure capitalism doesn't provide for everything needed, that there is a requirement to maintain a civil society and public goods that care for each other. That we can't just take and give the things we need per se, but we have to provide for each other. That there is a minimum in civic discourse of a sense that we are all obligated to the same nation and to its wherewithal and to its welfare. And these strange mitzvot, these six cities of refuge, they're easy to dismiss. They're easy to think, well, that's a trivial and odd one. And there are plenty of, as I pointed out, odd mitzvot in the Torah and beyond. But these, I think, have a value beyond that we might not see. And I think the question of building a civil society, building rule of law, enhancing civic discourse, is one that our Torah doesn't take lightly. That it is, in some ways, the cornerstone for a lot of the other mitzvot. And the Sefer HaChinuch, who is another medieval commentator who is one of the first codifiers of the laws, and as I mentioned before, he does it in a very beautiful way, in a very narrative way. So he takes the 613 mitzvot and tries to tell you the origins of them and the expansions of them and the way they operate in life. And it's not quite known who he was or whether he was writing sort of an ethical will for his children or what he was writing for. But he has this beautiful thing to say about the cities of refuge. And I don't know if his math is correct, but I like it. The Torah includes, as we often say, 613 mitzvot, but as noted in many places, no one can do all the mitzvot. He points out some mitzvot can only be observed before the temple was destroyed, some only after the temple is destroyed, and of the ones that can still be observed today, there are only 339 that remain to us. And then there are some mitzvot that you only get under certain circumstances, like if you employ someone, there are mitzvot in employment law that you have to address. There are prayer laws. There are certain laws, he says, that are only binding on certain days of the year. For example, the mitzvah to sit in the sukkah, that on Sukkot is the only time you have to, the first days of Sukkot are the only time you have to sit in a sukkah. You can't do it on Shemini Atzeret. Every other day is voided. So he comes to the conclusion that there are only six real mitzvot, or not, there are only six eternal and constant and consistent mitzvot. And again, I'm not sure his math is right, and I don't know where he gets these six, but I love the idea. They are to believe in God, to avow that God is one, to renounce idolatry, to love God, to fear God, and to avoid temptation to sin. And where does he get six? It's less about math than he connects it to the six cities of refuge. There are ultimately six important things in a Jewish life, and they're parallel to the building of the cities of refuge, and they contribute to the building of a just and fair and open and righteous society, one where we respect the law and we don't try to take the law in our own hands, and where we have a foundation upon which to do other good works. So that's where I'm beginning to think as we move towards the election season and towards our high holiday season. I'm sure I'll say more over the holidays, but thanks for letting me share my early thoughts with you today.